Here we go. Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we're in part four with David Seeloff on King David's Tomb, the location and future discovery. You can go to the Ask Elm website at www.askelm.com. Send email to David. And here's how you do that. David@askelm.com. And David Seeloff is the Director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge. He is carrying on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. And in part four, we are starting off here with House of David in Zechariah.
Right.
Hi. Okay, what's going on here?
Well, hi, Georgianne.
Hi.
Great to be back again. It's a pleasure and an honor. And the House of David in Zechariah, the last six chapters of Zechariah were actually prophecies that were given by the prophet Jeremiah, but they're under Zechariah's name. And this is confirmed in Matthew 27, verse 9, and an article on that Dr. Martin wrote called The Land of Israel in Prophecy, in which it shows, and also in his book, Dr. Martin's book about the Bible, Restoring the Original Bible, which discusses how the scriptures were canonized, mostly from information within the Bible itself. And anyway, the last six chapters of Zechariah were actually given by Jeremiah. So that, and that the last three chapters of Zechariah, 12, 13, and 14, are one single continuous prophecy. Remember last time we said that the vision of Ezekiel 40 to 48 was one vision.
Yes.
And in Zechariah, chapters 12, 13, and 14 are also one continuous prophecy given by Jeremiah. Now, chapter 12 tells about Israel's future victory over its enemies and then a mourning over him whom they have pierced. Chapter 13 relates how the idolatry in the future shall end in Israel and how the shepherd, in other words, those who are teaching religion in Israel, meaning the rabbis and the ministers, will be struck and will be scattered. Chapter 14 talks about the future war and the ultimate victory when the Messiah returns to the Mount of Olives. In these three chapters of Zechariah, there is a phrase, in that day, quote, in that day, end quote, which occurs 19 times, like a drumbeat throughout the prophecy. In that day, in that day, in that day. And it's amazing because we're not sure. Dr. Martin believed that the understood that this was a one single sequential prophecy, and it seems like that's the case. Another important phrase, quote, House of David, end quote, occurs five times between Zechariah chapter 12, verse 7, and chapter 13, verse 1. The reference is not to the royal descendants of David. Every instance of those five occurrences of the House of David, in my opinion, refers to a physical structure and indicates the sepulchres of King David. Now, Zechariah 12, verse 1, introduces the theme, which is the burden of Israel. In verses 2 and 3, we find that Jerusalem shall become a problem, quote, to all the people round about, end quote. In other words, to all the nations around Israel, and Jerusalem specifically, to Israel and to the nations around it, so much so that all the nations of the earth will gather against the city of Jerusalem.
And that we're kind of...
We're coming up to that point.
Yes, we are.
Jerusalem shall be a problem to all peoples and all nations on earth. That's what the text says.
Mm-hmm.
Then God shall intervene. The people shall depend, the people of Jerusalem and Israel shall depend on God rather than the United States or their weapons to save them. And he does. In verse 7 of Zechariah chapter 12, quote, the Lord shall also save the tents of Judah first, that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem do not magnify themselves against Judah.
Now, wait a minute.
Well, what does that mean?
Yeah. And what did all those prophecies for the future in Obadiah mean?
Yeah.
Where Edom comes and they want to destroy the people of Israel. And, I mean, they won't even let them escape.
Right. So, well, that occurs, but that occurs at the time of the Antichrist. And we're not there yet in
okay.
the Zechariah passage.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So, first notice that the tents of Judah will be saved first. And then the house of David is counterposed. There's already a glory of the house of David that somehow is already glorious. Now, and then there's the house of David, the glory of the house of David is counterposed to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Most commentaries will tell you that they both refer to people, both the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem. But this is incorrect. The house of David refers to the sepulchers of David, and the next verse says something remarkable, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem talks about the people.
Yeah.
The next verse says something remarkable about the house of David in verse Zechariah 12:8. Chapter 12 in verses 8 and 9, quote, in that day shall the Lord defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Doesn't say anything about the house of David yet.
And it doesn't say Israel, it says Jerusalem.
Jerusalem.
Yes.
And he that is feeble among the inhabitants of Jerusalem, at that day shall be as David. Now comes an interesting passage. And the house of David shall be as God, as Elohim, as the angel of the Lord before them. In other words, the house of David shall be as God and as the angel of the Lord before, in front of, the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Something in that house, if it's a physical structure, and I maintain that it is, will be as if God is talking to them face to face. As the angel of the Lord, a messenger. Angel means a messenger. As if a messenger from God, the angel of Yahweh, is in front of them. Something in that house. And it shall come to pass, continuing on, and it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. At that day, like it says. Now, in the future, the inhabitants of Jerusalem will be defended somehow by God, who will make even the weakest of them seem like King David at the height of his power.
Who lives in Jerusalem today?
Jews, Muslims, and Christians. And it's talking about everybody, in all the inhabitants, not just the Jews.
Right.
The Israelites.
Okay.
And this is... If it was talking about Judah, it would have specified, I maintain. It's talking about all the inhabitants of Jerusalem.
Right.
That's why it uses the phrase inhabitants of Jerusalem and not, you know, those of Judah.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. Now, we'll see who inhabits Jerusalem when that occurs. I don't think everyone else will be driven out. I don't see any other prophecy that indicates that. But the weakest will seem like King David. At the height of his power, somehow, they will be almost invincible. The next sentence about the house of David seems to inflate that power of the house to almost outrageous proportions. You know, shall be as God and the angel of the Lord before them. Whether he's going to be supermen? No, because the house of David is referring to a structure. The inhabitants of Jerusalem shall be as David, and very vital and powerful somehow.
What has gone on now? I mean, have the inhabitants been physically changed somehow?
No, I don't see that. It's just that they will be. God will give them such efficiency that they will somehow be able to fight off, and they will depend on God to do it somehow.
Okay.
If the House of David itself is a physical structure with something inside it so wondrous that people would think that God himself is communicating with them, as if God's personal messenger has come to them, you know, it says the angel of the Lord, the messenger of Yahweh before them.
Yes.
Now, this is not a hyperbolic, poetic comparison about the power of the inhabitants regarding the, you know, compared to the descendants of King David. God will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem. It says that specifically in verse 8, and destroy the attackers. It doesn't say anything about the inhabitants defending themselves. It's just that they're going to be of such spiritual power, perhaps, that they will have such faith to confront those who would destroy Jerusalem and the attackers. And this is all before the Antichrist.
Okay.
Don't ask me when.
No, I know.
Future.
It's the future. But this is not the time when they look upon him whom they pierced, right?
Well, that's the next verse.
Oh! I lost you about two pages ago, so that's amazing.
Now, there's something about the House of David that will lead the inhabitants of Jerusalem to recognize Jesus as their Messiah, as understood in John 19, chapter 19, verse 34, and Revelation 1, verse 7.
Right.
Now, in Zechariah 12, verses 10 and 11, we come to the verse that you were anticipating. Quote, "And I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication, and they, the inhabitants, shall look upon me whom they have pierced.
Oh my gosh.
And they shall mourn for him as one that mourns for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn son, who would die."
That gives me, I'll tell you, I got goosebumps.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Now, there's something in the house that will cause their minds to shift to accept Christ as their Messiah.
Even the Muslims. Wow.
Something so powerful, and we're not talking about the Ark of the Covenant or any foolishness like that.
Right.
We're not talking any mystical power or anything. We're talking about something in there that would so impress them, that would lead them to go from something of David to Jesus as their Messiah. Now,
This is powerful. It really is, David. Oh, my gosh.
And it's information. Yes. That's what's going to have the impact.
Yes.
Now, the very next verse has something very interesting also, but it's a little difficult. It's almost, in the next verse, it's almost impossible for me to claim that the word house of David refers to anything but a people group. However, this very peculiar what's being said here in chapter 12, verses 12 to 14 of Zechariah. Quote, "And the land shall mourn every family apart, the family of the house of David apart and their wives apart, the family of the house of Nathan apart and their wives apart, the family of the house of Levi apart and their wives apart, the family of Shimei apart and their wives apart. All the families that remain, every family apart, and their wives apart."
What does that mean?
Well, by getting some background, we can perhaps unpack this.
Oh, good.
First of all, Nathan was a son of David and a direct ancestor of Jesus. In other words, the Jesus line came through Nathan, at least on his legal genealogy. Now, Nathan was an older brother of Solomon. Yet Solomon was chosen by God to succeed David to the throne.
Yes.
Shimei was a common name among those who descended from Levi. So you have the house of David apart, house of Nathan. Nathan is the son of David. You have the house of Levi in the family of Shimei. Shimei is a son of Levi, or at least a common Levitical name.
Mm-hmm.
Closest to the grand Shimei is the closest Shimei is a grandson. If these four groups would be buried in their own tombs in separate chambers within that area, then this would make sense. If House of David means people, why add the phrase family? Why add the word family? Family of the House of David. Now, if there's the family of those who are buried in the tomb or House of David and their wives, then they would mourn. The family of the house of Nathan, who was buried in the tomb of Nathan, something would be significant to those people. Likewise, house of Levi, there might be a Levitical aspect to this, and we'll show that this relates to Huldah the prophetess later on. If these four groups would be buried in the tombs in different chambers for each family group, then this obscure verse would make more sense. We won't know till we get into the house of David. Now, the next verse in Zechariah chapter 13, verse 1 and 2, forget about the chapter designations. You know, this is a continuous narrative, 12, 13, and 14. In that day there shall be a fountain opened to the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and uncleanness. Now, do groups of people have fountains or springs open to them? Do structures have fountains open to them? Well, yes. If they're located near a spring, such as the Gihon spring, which was very close to the location of the house of David and the tombs of David. In Jeremiah 17, verse 13, it says that God is the fountain of living waters.
Right.
His living waters are healing waters, and to ignore them is a great evil. Remember that Jeremiah also wrote the Zechariah passages that we're reading of in Zechariah 12 and 13. In Jeremiah 2, verse 13, it says, quote, "For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the living fountain, the fountain of living waters, and they have hewn out cisterns, broken cisterns, that can hold no water." So that there's something about God being and living waters and a fountain open to the house of David, to what I believe is the structure, a physical structure, as we'll see, that gives a lot of information to the people and the families of David and the family of Nathan and the people, inhabitants of Jerusalem. And remember, it says at the end of verse 14 of Zechariah 12, and all the families that remain, every family apart and their wives apart. It could be that there are complete genealogies in these tombs, and that this might be what is referred to, have reference to. I don't know. They can't quite unpack every nuance of Zechariah 12, verses 13 and 14. But there's something going on here that's very interesting. If you look at the house of David as the tombs of David, now, we'll get into some very interesting things related to Josephus and the sepulchres of David. Now, Josephus tells of an event that took place during the reign of John Hyrcanus, king of Judah, son of Simon the Hasmonean. Hyrcanus, according to Josephus, in Antiquities of the Jews, 7.393. Hyrcanus, quote, opened one room of David's sepulcher and took out 3,000 talents, end quote. Josephus indicates that there was more than one room, that there were more rooms than just the one that Hyrcanus entered. So, correctly, we're concluding that there were multiple chambers, multiple rooms in David's sepulcher. and that the room that Hyrcanus entered, he took the treasure from. Elsewhere, Josephus gives us more information. This is in Antiquities, book 13, 249. Quote, "But Hyrcanus opened the sepulcher of David, who excelled all other kings in riches, and took out of it 3,000 talents." This is a restatement of what was said earlier. Mm-hmm. This passage tells us that there were probably more riches in other rooms of David's sepulcher, and we find out that that is indeed the case. The location of the sepulchers of David, was known to John Hyrcanus without doubt, but it was also known to others. It was known to Josephus as he tells this story. Josephus later tells us a fascinating story of when King Herod the Great, before Jesus was born and before the temple was built, King Herod tried to enter David's sepulcher. Now, I'm going to read a long passage from Antiquities of the Jews, 16.179-182. Quote, "As for Herod, he spent vast sums on the cities, both outside and inside his kingdom. And because he had before heard that John Hyrcanus, had been king before him, Herod had opened David's sepulcher." John Hyrcanus had opened David's sepulcher and taken out of it 3,000 talents of silver, and that there was a much greater number left behind. In other words, more treasure left behind. And indeed, enough to suffice all of his wants. In other words, great wealth remained in the sepulcher. He had a great while, in other words, a long time, an intention to make the attempt to enter the tombs of David. That's what Josephus is talking about. At this time, Herod, opened that sepulcher at night and went into it, and he endeavored that it should not be known at all in the city. In other words, what he was doing. And he took only his most faithful friends with him. As for money, he found none, as Hyrcanus had done, but that furniture of gold and those precious goods that were laid up there, all of which he took away.
Oh my goodness.
So Herod didn't find any money, John Hyrcanus did, but Herod found furniture of gold. Now this means wood furniture overlaid with gold.
Yeah.
Which was extant for about 1,000 years, almost 1,000 years after David had died, to the time of King Herod. And it talks about other precious goods that were in the tombs. Continuing on with Josephus. However, Herod had a great desire to make a more diligent search and to go farther into the chambers, even as far as the very bodies of David and Solomon.
Oh my. Oh.
Where two of his guards were slain by a flame that burst out upon those who went in, as the report was. In other words, Josephus is relating a document that he was used as a source. Now, what apparently happened was they had gone into the one chamber, which they took out some furniture, Herod and his associates.
The Edomites.
Yeah. Yes. They must have punched a hole in the next doorway or to the next chamber, put a torch up to the way. A flame blew out, killed his two friends. Herod ran out, and he was so, as it says, where his two guards were slain by a flame that burst out upon those who went in, as the report was. So Herod was terribly frightened and went out and built a propitiatory monument of that fright he had been in, and this of white stone at the mouth of the sepulcher, and that at great expense also. So Josephus doesn't say whether that mouth of the sepulcher and that monument were still there in his day. He's just reading this report, and Josephus wrote in 90 AD, and this took place before Jesus was born, so it was at least 100 years before that King Herod the Great had done this.
I've got a question.
Mm-hmm.
You know those weirdo knights that used to ride around. Their insignia was two weirdo guys riding on a little donkey, and they were knights, and they it was alleged they went into the Holy Land they used to dig at night in the stables of
the Knights Templar.
They were a bunch of weirdos.
Yeah, actually they dug and lived in Solomon's stables, which is north of where the tombs would have been.
Yeah, so they didn't find anything, right?
Yes, they did find something, but it had nothing to do with the tombs of David.
Okay.
I suspect what they found was probably one of the temple treasures from the Copper Scroll. Because the Copper Scroll talks about the one of the treasures being buried by a fountain of the temple, which would have been south of the Haram-e-Sharif, south of the Solomon Stables. The Solomon Stables are under the Haram-e-Sharif on the south side.
Okay.
So what they found had nothing to do with the tombs of David or with Christ, but they were able to convince the Catholic Church that these were significant finds.
Yes.
Supposedly, and that was something that I definitely looked into in my research, was to see, well, what did they find? It had nothing to do, because they were digging in the wrong place.
Yeah. A lot of people are digging in the wrong spot.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So they're about a third of a mile away, actually, or more. Actually, it would be a little bit more, maybe a couple hundred yards more. But what happened to King Herod also happened later when they tried to rebuild the temple. There was, during the time of Julian the Apostate, the Jews were given permission by Emperor Julian in about 365, 385. And there was a great earthquake. Julian the Apostate was only emperor for 3 years.
Yeah.
But he gave permission for the Jews to rebuild the temple, so they started laying the foundation, and they started to reconstruct the temple, and there was a great earthquake. And soon after the earthquake, fire came up out of the ground and killed a number of the workers, and the Jews took this as a very bad sign from God that maybe they shouldn't be rebuilding the temple.
No fooling.
And this is a historical record. I could cite you the source, and it's in my one of the articles that I wrote about the temple. I think it might be regarding the House of David.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, it is. I cite the source from the histories. A number of historians have commented on this. So it's not unusual where you have a source of water to have natural gas, which they would not have understood, and it's something we must take into account if and when we would be able to have access to the tombs.
Right.
It might be best to wear oxygen masks and not have any open flames. Because of the historical precedents.
Yeah, don't flick your bit down there.
Absolutely not. You might kill everything, so people, as well as destroy what's in there.
That's right.
I doubt if the decomposition of the bodies would have been a problem, would have caused some natural gas, but not a lot, but mostly from water. And I have to look into the fact whether natural gas would actually be a preservative. It might be.
Huh.
I don't know. Or it might deteriorate things.
Well, there's different kinds of natural gases, too.
True, true.
Yes.
But where there's rushing water, there's frequently gas pockets. And the whole area of Israel has gas and oil. They just haven't located it yet.
Yeah.
We know that for a fact from historical records and biblical records. But King Herod's episode, what happened to King Herod, gives us gives us excellent information. And King Herod's suspicions were correct. He knew the precise location of David's sepulcher, but once again, entering it was a problem.
Yeah.
He had an expectation of more treasure to be in the tomb, than what Hyrcanus had already taken away, and he was correct in that. He took furniture of gold with gold leaf on wood and other valuable objects, but no money. Josephus specifically states that Hyrcanus and Herod were both unsuccessful at getting to the bodies of David and Solomon, but he implies that the bodies were there. And indeed, we'll see later that David's body is indeed in the tomb, and this was stated by none other than the Apostle Peter at Pentecost.
Why would they want to get at the bodies to defile?
So that's probably where they would expect the treasure to have been there, the greatest treasures.
Oh, okay.
That's where the greatest treasure was for King Tut.
Oh, yeah.
Now, in Josephus Antiquities 7:394, it says, quote, Herod, the king, opened another room and took away a great deal of money, yet neither of them, neither Herod nor Hyrcanus, came at the coffins of the kings themselves, for their bodies were buried under the earth so artfully that they did not appear even to those who entered into their monuments. But so much shall suffice us to have said concerning these matters. In other words, Josephus is saying this is all we know about this.
Yeah.
But they weren't able to... They do know that the bodies were buried so artfully and so cleverly, not with trapdoors, but for some reason they were sealed in such a way that they couldn't get to it. Whether this was just like it says in Isaiah 22:22, that it'll be opened and no man can shut, and it'll be shut and no man can open it. Talking about the house of David, specifically. The key of the house of David, that's what it said in Isaiah 22:22. So notice how this all ties together.
Yes.
The word money in Greek, in these two passages, in Antiquities, frequently means simple possessions or wealth. In Antiquities 16:180, it says that Herod found no money. But in Antiquities 7:394, it says that he did. So I can't really reconcile these two passages in Josephus. But in any case, Josephus tells us that Herod became frightened because of the fire, killing his fellow grave robbers, and he never entered the tombs again, so far as we know. Actually, Josephus further records that Herod's family troubles started after this point.
Oh my.
In history.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, Josephus actually says that a lot of people felt that his problem started as a result of his evil act in trying to enter David's tomb.
Well, and he's just an Edomite grave robber.
Yeah. You know, and he was cursed, yes. Actually.
Yes.
In fact...
Well, he cursed himself by doing that terrible thing.
Right, right. In fact, after relating, God will open and God will shut.
Right.
And nobody like Herod's going to get into it. Now, whether Herod knew that, I don't know. But after Josephus discusses Herod's family troubles, you know, he killed his sons left and right. Yeah. He had about 8 wives like Henry VIII. He had a whole mess of wives, and he killed them off.
He was crazy.
Evil.
Yeah.
Very evil.
Yeah.
But after Josephus talks about Herod's family troubles, the very next subject Josephus talks about is Herod's sudden desire to expand and glorify the temple.
Mm-hmm.
And one wonders if his night attempt to enter the sepulchres of David didn't prompt guilt within Herod to attempt to do penance to God, mm-hmm. and to glorify God's temple and make it great.
Right.
You just wonder. Josephus doesn't say that, but you do kind of wonder about
that.
That's
a good point.
So, you know, we don't know. You know, it does say that he was so frightened, and then he put this monument at the front, and, you know, we don't know. This propitiatory monument that it says Herod constructed would not have been placed at a moved tomb, because whoever moved the tombs, you know, could have gotten at the treasure. And John Hyrcanus could have gotten at all of the treasure, but he didn't. Mm-hmm. So this is another reason why we think that these were not tombs that were moved by Simon the Hasmonean. In any case, it makes sense. The monument would have been at the mouth of the sepulcher, a cave-like structure. But after Herod put this, somehow that monument went away. We don't know. Perhaps after Herod's death, the Jews removed it. We don't know. It might have been there at the time of Peter, you know, at Pentecost. We don't know. But the mouth of a sepulcher means a structure, a cave-like structure,
right,
to me. Now, I propose that according to this information, the sepulchers of David and Solomon were not moved by Simon the Hasmonean for two reasons. First, they contained the bodies of righteous kings whose tombs did not defile the sanctuary, according to Ezekiel 43. And more importantly, their sepulchers were far underground in bedrock, and that Simon reduced the hill to where the temple was located in bedrock. He did not carve into the bedrock, and Dr. Martin makes this clear from his historical sources in his book, Temples That Jerusalem Forgot. Now, there's a relationship between David and Jesus, besides Jesus being David's descendant.
Right.
They were associated by the Apostle Peter on the day of Pentecost after Jesus' ascension. Speaking from Jerusalem, Peter says in Acts 2:29 and 34 and 35, quoting from Psalm 110, Peter's speaking at Pentecost. He says, "I may say to you freely of the patriarch David that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. Uh-huh. For David ascended not into the heavens, but he, David, said himself, the Lord said unto my Lord, sit you at my right hand till I make your enemies the footstool of your feet." Now, reading the text of Acts 2:29 critically, Peter knew where David's tomb was.
Yeah.
And it almost seems as if it's visible to Peter and to his audience. Almost as if Peter is gesturing to it while he's speaking.
Yeah.
Peter understood that David's body was in the tomb. In other words, it hadn't been moved.
Right.
And not only that, but then Peter makes a relationship between David and Jesus. If David is dead, buried, and his tomb is still with us, then the body should be there also.
Right.
That phrase, his tomb is still with us to this day, is meaningful if one remembers that many of the tombs were moved by Simon the Hasmonean. In other words, it hadn't been moved. That's what I take Peter as saying, that David's tomb was not put elsewhere and that the body of David is in the original tomb. David's sepulcher would be south of the temple at God's right hand, facing east, exactly as Psalm 110 states, as cited in Acts 2:35. The Apostle Paul later spoke, as Peter did, about King David. And once again, he starts with David and makes a transition to talk about Jesus' seed, David's seed, Jesus. This is in Acts 13, chapter 13. Jesus, he identifies as the Savior of Israel. When Paul told of Jesus' resurrection from the dead and contrasted David with Jesus, David saw corruption in the grave, while his body was not corrupted. Now, this is in Acts 13, verses 34 to 37. Quote, "And as concerning that he raised him up from the dead," meaning talking about Jesus, "now no more to return to corruption, he said on this wise," quote, "I will give you the sure mercies of David," quoting Psalm 55, verse 3. "Wherefore," he says also in another psalm, quote, "you shall not suffer your Holy One to see corruption," Psalm 16:16. "For David, after he had served his own generation by the will of God, fell on sleep and was laid unto his fathers and saw corruption. But he, Jesus, he whom God raised, saw no corruption. Now remember, David was compared by Peter that David's tomb is still with us and his body, but Jesus was resurrected. That was the whole point of Peter's speech. Paul did the same thing. David was dead, he's buried, his body saw corruption and is corrupting, but Jesus, who God raised, saw no corruption. There's something going on here between David and Jesus. Remember Zechariah, it talks about him, the house of David. There's something in the house of David that will relate to and make people understand and realize him whom they have pierced.
Yes.
So you have Peter, you have Paul, you have Zechariah. Something about David and that tomb that will help them recognize him whom they have pierced in Zechariah 12:10. The Apostle John states specifically in John 19, verse 37, that this him whom they have pierced refers to Jesus Christ. Now, Rabbi Akiva, who was born around 40 A.D. and died about 135, wrote this, an intriguing passage, after the destruction of the temple, about the burials and the tombs within the city of David. And he refers to the clearing away of the sepulchers, which happened 300 years before Rabbi Akiva lived, meaning likely the sepulchers of the kings of Judah. Now, this is in the Tosfeta, Baba Batra 1.2 and 11 and 12. Quote, in Jerusalem it was not permitted to leave the tombs, in other words, within the city, with the exception of those of the house of David and those of the prophetess Huldah. All the sepulchers should be cleared away except the sepulcher of a king and the sepulcher of a prophet. Rabbi Akiva says, even the sepulcher of a king and the sepulcher of a prophet should be cleared away. But, Rabbi Akiva was told, but there were at Jerusalem the sepulchers, plural, of the house of David and the sepulcher, singular, of Huldah the prophetess, and nobody ever touched them. Mm-hmm. To which he, Rabbi Akiva, replied, do you adduce these as evidence? There was a tunnel in them through which the uncleanness went forth to the valley of Kidron. In other words, not exactly sure what this means here, but there was a tunnel near the sepulchers through which the uncleanness, meaning from the temple, went forth into the valley of Kidron. First, notice what Rabbi Akiva was told. He was told about the sepulchers of the house of David. Now, it's easy to see how house of David could come to mean the sepulchers of David. Second, note that there was a tunnel of uncleanness close to the sepulchers of the house of David and the sepulcher of Huldah. Perhaps seepage of some of the gas from the waste materials seeping through the limestone could have, you know, produced the natural gas that killed King Herod's helpers, and also during the time of Simon the Hasmonean. Anyway, there was the tunnel of uncleanness close to the sepulchers of the house of David and the sepulcher of Huldah. The term uncleanness is a direct reference to Zechariah 13, verses 1 and 2 above, and we'll get into this.
Okay.
Third is a most significant point. Nobody ever touched those two sepulchers, according to this rabbi, after 70 A.D. That means that according to this author, who wrote after the destruction of the temple and the city of Jerusalem, the expectation was that the bodies of David's family and Huldah the prophetess would still be inside intact sepulchers. This means that the Romans did not enter the sepulchers, even though Josephus, a friend to Rome apparently knew where those sepulchres were. And this means that the Romans, with all the time and resources in the world after the destruction of Jerusalem, were not able to access these tombs. Now, consider this. The Romans had all the power and the time in the world. Josephus says that they tortured the Jews who were in charge of the temple to tell them where all the temple treasures were buried. In other words, perhaps the treasures from the copper scroll. Some of them they obviously missed. But they were not able to get to the tombs of King David and perhaps Solomon. How do we know that? Well, Rabbi Akiva says they didn't get to the tombs, and also there is an argument from silence in Josephus. If they would have gotten to the tombs, if the Romans would have gotten to the tombs, this would have been the final thumb on the neck and the history of the Jewish nation to plunder the tomb of King David. Believe me, Josephus would have mentioned it. It would have been a big deal. And Josephus would have been in those tombs because he was a personal friend of the person who later became the emperor. Vespasian and Titus both, he was a friend of both of them. And he had full access to all the Roman records and all the temple records. It even says that Josephus had a copy of the Torah that was in the temple in his personal possession.
Oh my goodness.
That was taken by the Romans from the temple. He had good contacts.
Yeah, he certainly did.
Now, just a few more and then we'll take another break.
Okay.
And so there's a chain of evidence here. Remember from Ezekiel 43:8-9, the carcasses of the kings were just one wall of separation apart from the carcasses of the kings and the sanctuary of the temple. I showed that that was the south wall of the sanctuary, as far as we can tell. And most of the sepulchres were moved by Simon the Hasmonean, according to Rabbi, even in history, but also specifically by Rabbi Akiva just above. Two groups of sepulchres were not moved. Those were the sepulchres of the house of David and the sepulchres of Huldah the prophetess. Now, in the Mishnah Midot, 1.3, Danby translation, it says there were five gates, quote, there were five gates to the temple enclosure. The two gates of Huldah from the south, which served for entrance and for exit. Now, there was only one set of gates in the southern wall of this temple enclosure, and they happened to be named the Gates of Huldah. Why? Because they pointed in the direction leading from the temple through that gate to the area where the sepulcher of Huldah was buried. That's my point. And I propose that the significant location was the sepulcher of Huldah, which is just where it should be located. Now,
you've put together some brilliant things here, Cleo.
Yeah. The gates of Huldah must point to something significant of Huldah. Why not the sepulchres? And by the way, it happened to be on the southern wall. Those gates were through the southern wall. Now, one more portion here, and then we'll take another break. In the Babylonian Talmud, Yoma 77b and 78a, and this is all, the entire thing is cited in Dr. Martin's article on the ASK website called Water Management in Herod's Temple. It says, quote, this is a long quote, Rabbi Phinehas, in the name of Rabbi Huna of Sepphoris, said, the spring that issues from the Holy of Holies at its beginning resembles the antenna of locusts. As it reaches the entrance of the sanctuary, it becomes as the thread of the warp as it reaches the olam. It grows larger and larger, and becomes, in other words, the water from the temple, the wastewater is washing, and it becomes greater and greater. And Rabbi Eleazar ben Jacob said, hence go forth the waters which will bubble forth from under the threshold of the sanctuary. From there onwards, it becomes bigger, rising higher and higher, until it reaches the entrance to the house of David. And this is at the bottom of the Ophel slope, a place called the Ophel slope, where David pitched his house or tabernacle for the Ark of the Covenant at the Gihon Springs. As soon as it reaches the entrance to the house of David at the Gihon Springs, it becomes even as a swiftly running brook, which men and women afflicted with gonorrhea, menstruating women and women after childbirth, bathe to cleanse themselves. As it is said, in that day there shall be a fountain opened to the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for purification and for sprinkling. Quoting specifically Zechariah 13:1, demonstrating that the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, recognizes the passage in Zechariah 13 that the phrase house of David means a physical location in distinct and definite relationship to the temple, to the waters, to the wastewaters of the temple in the southeast corner. This can only make sense if you use Dr. Ernest Martin's revised understanding of the location of the temple above and west of the Gihon Springs, and that the Haram-e-Sharif is the remains of Fortress Antonia. There's no other way to look at this. And this is a good place to break. And the next time we'll put everything together and we'll start getting into the what might be in the tombs. And that's the really fun part.
You know, my goodness, I really, many times while you have been reading this, David, I just get goosebumps. I mean, you have put together, God has given you some real guidance on this, and the Holy Spirit has been with you in putting all this together. It's brilliant.
Well, you know, if anything's been done, it's been on the shoulders of Dr. Martin and Professor Buchanan and George Wesley Buchanan and Gary Arvidson with his background research work in regard to the history of David's tomb. But some of these elements are, you know, my standing on their shoulders on this stuff. But it's they're still there, and they should be opened, and we need to find a way to do it. We'll see.
Well,
it's up to God. God's going to open them or make it available.
That's right. He will at some point. I mean, all the evidence points that way, and it is very, very exciting. It really is.
And when you understand what might be in the tombs, you will then understand the passage in Zechariah where it says that the house of David shall be as God, like a messenger from Yahweh, speaking to the people, to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. It will all suddenly make sense, and you will see exactly, and it'll be Muslims, Christians, and Jews. Of course, it would have the greatest impact on Jews, but it will be considered a marvelous thing, a miracle.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
yeah.
And it will change things. It will, in my understanding, my guesstimate, if you will, it will have a major impact in the restitution of all things that Peter talks about in Acts chapter 3.
Wow.
So, but this doesn't fit anybody else's scenario or even my own. So we're walking a line of discovery here as we, you know, each puzzle piece that we put together.
Well, you know, in Isaiah, it also says that there will be no more secrets. Everything will be made known.
That's right.
And it's the, I don't believe that.
It's the God's glory to conceal a thing, but it's the glory of kings to find them out. And we're more than kings as children of God. And why not us? Why shouldn't we participate in this discovery? Why should, you know, unbelievers discover it? The glory will go to God,
absolutely,
no doubt, but we should be able to trumpet that information, that information was there all the time. In other words, God's been putting this, has David's tomb under everyone's nose for 3,000 years, mm-hmm. and he's going to shake up the world.
Well, yes, we know he is. And, you know, when you think about all the hatred and the bloodshed that has been spilled over these 3,000 years, we know from Scripture that that will come to an end. And there's something, like you say, and this, you know, praise the Lord, this may be it.
Pressure is building on the world stage to, you know, people are getting desperate. They don't know where to turn. Their hearts are failing them for fear. Well, does God leave people without hope? Not really. Not ever.
No.
So.
Oh, wow. Anyway, this is the end of part four. We will continue. And God bless all of you out there that are listening. Believe me, the next segment is going to just really knock your socks off, so stay tuned.
It'll put everything together.
Yes, yes. This is exciting. And you've been listening to David Seeloff. He is the narrator. And this series is King David's Tomb, The Location and the Future Discovery. Email David Seeloff at this address, david@askelm.com. That's askelm.com. ELM stands for the initials of Ernest L. Martin. The website, askelm.com, has got just a wealth of information on it, study, scripture, commentary, prophecy. Believe me, it's a wonderful, wonderful website. And you can learn a lot by going there and jumping in and doing some study on your own. Also, books are made available for free for download on the website. So, I mean, what more can you ask for, people? God bless all of you listeners. Pray. Pray that this discovery comes to fruition, that it is brought to fruition. This is of importance to every race, every tongue, every color on this planet. And need I say more? God bless you, David Seeloff, for doing all this and making this information available to the Bite Show listeners. And we will be back. So, this is Georgia News with David Seeloff, signing off from part four in our series, King David's Tomb, The Location and Future Discovery. We will be back very soon. Good night, everybody, and God bless you.